Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. In honor of Veterans Day, we'll hear a talk by Earl Stube, a member of the 20th Air Force, 315th Bomb Wing in Guam during World War II. Later becoming a prominent teacher, serving as principal of Fort LaBeef High School in Waterford Township, Pennsylvania from 1955 to 1966, and then as superintendent of the Fort LaBeef Schools. Dr. Stube will speak on the topic, Americans, Fighting for Peace in Asia. His remarks were given as part of Asian Culture Week, presented annually by the Asian World Center at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, September 10, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sharon Ishii Jordan, Associate Professor of Education and Associate Dean of the Creighton University College of Arts and Sciences.
Dr. Stube was a member of the 20th Air Force 315th Bomb Wing in Guam during World War II. He began his time in the Army Air Corps in May 1942 and traveled around the country for training. His first experience in Nebraska came in Grand Island, 1945 in April, when he was posted to the 315th Bomb Wing. It was there that he met his crew and trained in their B-29 for flying five missions in Guam later that year. In 1949, Dr. Stube received his master's degree from Columbia University before going on to complete his doctorate in education at Penn State University in 1962. His career in education included teaching math, science, and geography at the secondary level for 7 years, before becoming principal of a high school in Waterford, Pennsylvania. He continued in education, serving as the assistant superintendent of the Erie County Public Schools from 1966 to 1971, and then as assistant director of the Northwest Tri-County Intermediate Unit, before retiring in 1981. However, he is not officially retired, as I understand. He continues to do work that may be assigned to him from school districts or from the community for volunteer work. In our conversations before this presentation, I found out a couple commonalities. My father also joined the Army Air Corps in 1942, and he came out of Offutt here in Omaha. And with Dr. Stube and myself, we both have an education career serving in as teachers and administrators in K-12 education. Dr. Stube's presentation today is part of Creighton's ninth Asian Culture Week event. The Asian Culture Week is partially sponsored by the University Non-Western Culture Committee. We thank you all for coming to today's program. Now please join me in welcoming Dr. Stube for his presentation.
Thank you very much. I hope it's all right if I'm permitted to use my cane. You know, I was born in 1920, so you can calculate my age, I think, fairly easily from that piece of information. So you understand why I don't always use this cane, but just on special occasions when. Things get a little turmoiled. Going back to my retirement in 1981, I was employed as the assistant executive director of the Northwest Tri-County Intermediate Unit. When I got so I couldn't say all of that in one breath, I figured it was time to retire. But was indicated, I really not completely retired. When the war broke out in 1941, I was 21 years old, and the draft board was breathing down my neck, and so I decided that I didn't want to be a dog face or whatever, as much as I respect people from the Army infantry. I decided I didn't want to do that. I spent the first years of my life as a farm boy on a dairy farm in northwestern Pennsylvania. So I signed up. A good friend of mine became a meteorologist in the Air Corps, and he said, why don't you sign up to be meteorologist? You know, you've got a good math background, and so that would be a good place for you. And so I did. I enlisted in the Army Air Corps as a meteorologist. So that was in May of 1942, and they didn't call me until the following February. So in the middle of February, in Erie, Pennsylvania, February is not the most pleasant place to live. So they shipped me to Miami Beach, it was funny. They were going to put us up in a hotel, a Seattle hotel, 31st and Collins Avenue, and. We didn't have any place to put our clothes, so I felt kind of silly walking up down the sidewalk on Miami Beach in February with an overcoat and my goulashes on. But anyhow, we survived that, and I took basic training at Miami Beach on one of the golf courses, and there was no school open, so I did basic training again. Then they sent me to St. Louis, to Washington University. So I spent 6 months in Washington University taking math, which was, they called it pre-meteorology. So I had a good dose of math up into differential equations. If any of you were in that department, I had a good math background, and I would recommend that for anybody that's going into the services. Eventually they decided they didn't need any more meteorologists, so they sent me back to Jefferson Barracks on just south of St. Louis on the Mississippi River to do basic training. A third time I did basic training. So... Then I went through the rigmarole and became an aerial navigator, graduated from Ellington Field in Houston in November of 1944, and got my commission as a second lieutenant and as an aerial navigator. We graduated on Saturday, November 4th, 1944. The next morning, I got on a train for Erie, Pennsylvania, and I got to Erie on the following Monday. My college sweetheart and I were married on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we had our honeymoon. And on Thursday, I was on a train going for Victorville, California. And my brand-new wife stayed behind, and I didn't see her for another 6 months after that. But anyhow, what I was going into at Victorville was a radar training program. I think they decided that I might do well in the radar field, and so I was trained as a aerial radar observer. And just a little bit about the radar bombardier. Relationship. I'm sure you've heard of the Norden bomb sight, which is standard equipment on most other bombardiers. It was in World War II. I don't think it is anymore. But the Norden bomb sight is a visual type of an instrument. The major component of a Norden bomb sight is a big spyglass or telescope. And of course, if those of you who have done much flying know that as you look out the window from an airplane, it's quite often covered with clouds and a telescopic type of an instrument would not be of much use. So that's why they developed the Eagle radar set, which converts the information from the for the bomb run into the Norden bomb site. And so that was the basis of our operation at Grand Island. After going through the Norden bomb site training in Boca Raton and the Eagle radar training in Victorville, California, I was assigned to the 315th Bomb Wing and the 502nd Bomb Group, which was located in Grand Island, Nebraska. So I spent about 6 months, well, no, not quite, maybe 3 months in Grand Island, where I met my crew. We got our B-29. We learned how to fly it, and swung the compass and did all the things that we are required in the bomb site, a bombing group, and we took off for California, and from California on to Heckam Field in Honolulu, and we got a chance to circle Pearl Harbor at that point, and there was still a good bit of damage showing in Pearl Harbor, and we went on to Guam and settled at the Northwest Field in Guam. So you may have heard a little bit about the last mission of World War II, and I was part of that. It seems that the Emperor of Japan had decided, you know, this is on the 14th of August of 1945, and the two atom bombs were dropped on the 6th and the 9th, so just a little bit over a week before that. And so the question was came up was as to what to do with the last oil refinery. The Japanese had moved that farther north. They thought it was far enough north that we couldn't reach it. But by putting a special gas tank, in, reducing the number of bombs that we were carrying, we were able to reach that. And there were two reasons, I think, basically. Number one, the Soviet Union. The Soviets were interested in this oil refinery, and they had a very large contingent of people in the area of Vladivostok. And so President Truman, who of course had the final decision as to whether or not to bomb this, was torn between two things. First, we didn't want the Russians to the Soviets or to get in there and do what they did in Germany, where they moved in at the last minute, said, "Okay, here we are," and then they partitioned Germany, and you had the east and west sections of Berlin and east and west Germany, and we didn't want that to happen in Japan. And secondly, the emperor and the head of the imperial army were having difficulty. The army and navy top brass wanted to continue the war. The Japanese emperor had dictated a message declaring that the Japanese were surrendering, and that was scheduled to be broadcast on the 15th. That recording was hidden somewhere in the Imperial Palace. And during the night of the 15th, President Truman said, go ahead and take out the Akita plant because he didn't want the Russians. The Russians were very much interested in getting their hands on this oil that was located in this particular area. So in the process of the planes coming from Guam, flying right over Tokyo, going up to here, the Imperial Palace was blacked out. And so the Imperial generals had their men in there trying to find this recording that the emperor had made so that they could destroy it and it would not be broadcast the following day. But because of the 315th going up to bomb the Akita oil fields, the Imperial Palace was blacked out. The army people never did find that recording, and it was broadcast the next day, and the war was over. The Soviets never got into Japan, and so there were two things that could have happened that didn't. Hopefully, the work of the 315th bombing had something to do with it. The United States may have been put into a position of trying to invade Japan. That would be one of the other possibilities. If they had done that, I'm not sure I'd be here today, because the death toll would have been substantial. Secondly, the Russians never got into Japan. And I'm not quite sure, but I sort of suspect they would rather have the Americans there than the Soviets. Maybe that's wishful thinking on my side, but I think it was better for the rebuilding of Japan to have the Americans around than it was to have the Soviets involved. So anyhow, that's a couple of the things that might have been. It's possible that we would ended up invading Japan, and it would not been good for either side. And of course, the other possibility would have been that the Soviets got involved, and we were. President Truman was trying to see what he could do to prevent that. So anyhow, on our way back to Guam that morning, we picked up the radio message that the war was over, and we had a big celebration when we got back on base, and I won't get into that. At least I'm thankful that it didn't happen, because I probably would have been right in the middle of it. I think one of the best things that I did during the time that I was in the service was helping to repatriate the prisoners of war in Japan. Basically, the thing that happened was as soon as the announcement was made that the war was over, the guards at the prisoner of war camps walked away. And so we had some of these big camps were, you know, jammed with people and nothing to eat. And So we had some parachutes stockpiled in Manila. And we took a ride over to Manila, and I was one of the planes that did it. And our crew we took a ride in Manila, and we loaded up the bomb bay with as many parachutes as we could get in. And we got the Seabees, who were also located on Guam. They started packaging stuff together, and they built crates. We attached a couple parachutes to each one of them, loaded them on a B-29, and went up and dropped them off at the various prisoners of war camp. But I think the important thing was this whole question of what happened, what might have been. What would have happened had we not flown the last mission? What if the Japanese army guys found those? You see, they had nothing to lose because if since they lost the war, these guys had to commit suicide anyhow, and so. There was nothing for them to lose other than to keep the war going. But we're all, at least I'm thankful that didn't happen, and I think everybody else is better off for that. I don't know if you have any questions. As you can tell, I'm not up to doing this on a regular basis. Yes.
You mentioned the 20 Air Force on Guam. I read a book. It said American used to put 100 B-29 in Chengdu in China. They thought China could be a good base to bomb Japan and Home Island. But it ends that it didn't work because there are corruptions, all those things, a civil war in China. So they changed the mind. They move all those those 100 B-29 to Guam. So the book I read was written by a Japanese soldier or a Japanese writer. The comments on that book is the success in China actually. Wasn't make much good to Japanese. All American did is ship the air base from Chengdu to Guam. Is your 20 Air Force or the Air Force from Chengdu?
Wait, now there were five bomb wings in the 20th Air Force. The 58th was the first one. Now it did fly out of. These flights originated in India, and they flew over the hump.
Yeah.
You've heard of the over the hump flights over the, did you say Himalayan or Himalayan,
yeah.
whichever. we have a reunion each year, and we do have some fellows there from the 58th. Bomb wing who were involved in the early flights, and it was a tough. The weather over the top of those mountains was a real problem, and there was a little island. there's an island called Rota. Which is halfway between Guam and Saipan. And the United States didn't capture every one of these islands. They bypassed some. And there was an airfield on Rota. And the soldiers who were left on there from the Japanese Army would fill in. They were trying to keep this airfield functioning so that someday maybe they'll come and be rescued off of the island of Rota. But they sent one of our planes up every Saturday morning to fly down the runway and bomb that little runway full of holes. Then these poor guys would work all week with their shovels and wheelbarrows filling up the holes. And the next Saturday morning, when another B-29 go down and blow up full walls again. But there were still soldiers on Guam. Every time we took off on a mission, if we had any food left in our barracks, when we came back from the mission, the food would be gone. Mm-hmm. So we used to get a lot of fruit cakes. That's one thing that people could send to us, and then they didn't spoil very easily, and so everybody had, you know, half a dozen fruitcakes in their footlocker. One time we took off on a mission, we come back, the fruitcakes were all gone. These guys come out of the cave, and they saw the planes take off, and so, you know, there's not going to be anybody in the barracks, so they kind of stocked up so that they could survive in the cave for a while longer.
Well, thanks. My second question is, I also read a book. It's about General Curtis LeMay.
Yes.
He was the one did this last bombing on Tokyo. Did you ever met him? What is your comments about LeMay?
Well, he was a guy that I think developed the bombing procedure that we used. He was behind. Remember, he had the pictures of the B-29 with all the gun turrets removed, and that was General LeMay's idea to do that, and the idea of. He didn't like the saturation bombing in. You know, prior to the 315th, any bombing that was done by heavy bombers was done in formation. You know, they'd be in a big V-tape formation, and when the lead plane dropped his bombs, everybody else dropped their bombs and hoped that somebody hit something. And they were bombing from 30,000 feet, so General LeMay moved us down to between 15 and 20,000 feet, so we're only half as high as we were originally, and we were a lot more accurate, and by each plane dropping their bombs earlier, we were a lot more successful in terms of eliminating the oil supply from the Japanese army. Yes.
When you mentioned that the oil supplies were a good target because it didn't raise the questions that other targets did, what in Michael Walzer's book on Just Wars, he said this about. Bombing civilian targets. He said that at the beginning of World War II, radar wasn't very good, and so there wasn't much accuracy. And then radar improved during the war.
Yes.
And you were kind of talking about a different improvement during the war in terms of how the planes were flown. Did the improvement of radar affect how the targets were chosen in Japan, like to distinguish military and non-military targets? He was focused on Europe, and he said that became more possible to distinguish military and non-military targets.
The Eagle radar that we used was much better. I used both, it was a lot more identify. It was easier to identify targets with the Eagle. The detail that you could see on the radar screen. Was considerably better. Of course, one problem that we had, the Norden bomb sight measured angles. You know, if you're up here and the target is out there, the Norden bomb sight would start measuring at 70 degrees, and as the bombardier would set the speed of the, there was a motor on this telescope, And there was variable speed, so he could speed up or slow down this motor. And so when the crosshairs stayed on the target, then the bomb site opened the bomb bay doors. The bomb site released the bombs. The bomb site closed the doors at the end. But the radar was used to feed the information into the bomb site. Of course, I use this when I talk to student groups and tell these kids, learn your math. If you ever get in the service, and you don't want to live in a foxhole, learn your math because the bomb site, the radar measures distance, and you got to convert that to an angle. So how do you do that? You got any math majors here? it's probably a simple trig at a cosine. you've got a right triangle and you know the altitude of so you've got one side the radar set measures the distance to the target, and so the cosine is the adjacent side divided by the hypotenuse, and so that's basic trig. But when we went into a mission, we knew what our assigned altitude was, so we knew what one side was of our right triangle, and then we could calculate what the distance to the target had to be when they went to be 70 degrees. So we could from the cosine of 70 degrees, you work backwards and find out when this is 26,514 feet, well, then you're at 70 degrees. So that's one thing we always emphasize to our young people, that they should learn the math.
I have a question.
Okay.
Dr. Stubbe, thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. And we are very honored that you are here with us. This is a question with one statement with three short questions. One, the defeat of Japan really meant the beginning of a long-standing peace in Asia. As an American who fought, who almost lost life, who saw so much sacrifice on the part of Americans, ever thought that Japan owned America apology. For those who were liberated with American sacrificing their life in Asia, ever thanked America enough? Or have you ever thought you are an American hero, not only for America as a great nation, but also for the people who enjoy the peace in Asia and the rest of the world?
I think a lot about that. It seems that with the wars in the Middle East, that every one of these guys that comes back from Syria or Saudi Arabia or something, he's a hero. No, I never thought of myself as being a hero. We did what we thought needed to be done, and I'm just a plain old guy that grew up on a dairy farm in northwestern Pennsylvania. Not no kind of a hero, but we had a job to do and we did it, and so. So anyhow, that's as far as the hero business. I don't consider myself to be a hero. I hope I did my job well, and I think I kept, hopefully I kept up my share of the of the responsibility with for our crew and for the group that we were flying with. But I have all kinds of respect for the guys that we're with. I talked about Ed Jajak. He died about 2 weeks ago. And so I really felt bad. I lost a good friend. And so there's not so many of us left anymore. Yes.
All right. You were talking a little bit about the B-29 and just how it was able to last that long, and I've heard that it's a very resilient plane. What were your opinions of the B-29 and how it functioned, and do you think other modifications could have been made to make it better?
The B-29 had some problems. It was built very fast. You know, at the beginning of the war, you didn't know anything about a B-29 yet. By 1945, there were hundreds of them in the air. But and we did have problems, with the oil thing, and the oil lines would break, and then they'd catch on fire when this oil would go on the manifold, So we had all kinds of problems with the B-29, but by and large it was a very airworthy. You know, we flew that thing through this typhoon, and they tore the ailerons off of it, but yet still we were able to fly the thing a couple hundred miles and land it. And any landing that you walk away from is a good landing.
Faster than anything the Japanese had.
That was one of the advantages in that that we could probably fly as fast in a B-29 as the Japanese fighter planes. Of course, the Japanese had a lot of other problems. For example, they didn't have self starters on their fighter planes, and so what they would do, they had an engine on the back of a truck and a shaft. They'd line them all up in a nice straight row. And then they'd go down that row with this truck and stop in front of each one and run a shaft over to the hub, propeller hub to start the plane. Of course, our fighter guys would go up there, and boy, they wring in their hands. They got all these planes in a nice straight row. Well, we can wipe out that whole Kashmir with one pass. So in some ways the Japanese army was very very good, but they did have a few little problems like that caused them some difficulty.
I had a question about more so just asking your impression on a couple of things. The first one was, how did you hear that the war was over? Was it something? Was it a radio message or
we picked it up on the radio?
Oh, okay. And I was just kind of wondering your impression on how that felt once it was announced it was over. And I was also wondering, had you heard about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the atomic bomb, and what kind of the impression of you and your crew might have been at the word of that?
Okay, first question. The B-29 had a padded tube about 2.5 feet in diameter that went from the front compartment to the back compartment, and both were went through the bomb bay, and they were padded. And we like to go back in that tube and take a nap. I still remember when we first left the United States, we had the group supply officer with us. Now, he didn't fly very much. And so we were about an hour out of San Francisco, and this major was the supply officer. He was looking out the window, and all he can see is water. And so he turned and looked at the navigator, and he's up in his tube sleeping. So he go and taps a pilot on the shoulder and say, "Hey, Gordon's in the tube sleeping." And the pilot kind of laughed and he says, when you see him at that desk working like mad, then you get worried. If he's up there sleeping, no, don't worry. So that was his supply there. Now, as far as the atom bomb, really, that was the best kept secret that I know of. We really didn't know anything about that until it was all over. Even though it was our own outfit, 315th, that actually dropped the atom bombs. But that particular facet was handled out of Tinian, which is a separate island, quite a distance away from Guam. So, it was a terrible thing to kill so many people. But that's war, I guess. War's not pretty, no matter how you try to slice it.
We really appreciate the sacrifice by the Americans fighting in Asia, defeat the Japanese, liberated a lot of people in Asia. So I wonder, do we have one last question? Dr. Stubbe has been standing here for 1 hour and 15 minutes at the age of 94. So, on behalf of the Asian World Center at Creighton University, with deep, deep appreciation and wonderful, wonderful gratitude that we have, allow me to present this small token of appreciation to Dr. Stubbe for what he has been doing after the war as an American hero that he does not claim himself to be, but he is truly an American hero. So, Dr. Stubbe, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate this. Is
and thank you.
An appreciation.
I thank you very much. I will display this in a very prominent place in my home.
Thank you. Please join me again in thanking Dr. Stubbe for his wonderful, wonderful presentation today. Thank
you. You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. In honor of Veterans Day, we heard a talk by Earl Stubbe, a member of the 20th Air Force, 315th Bomb Wing in Guam during World War II. Later becoming a prominent teacher, serving as principal of Fort LaBeouf High School in Waterford Township, Pennsylvania from 1955 to 1966, and then as superintendent of the Fort LaBeouf Schools. Dr. Stubbe spoke on the topic, Americans Fighting for Peace in Asia. His remarks were given as part of Asian Culture Week, presented annually by the Asian World Center at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, September 10th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Maorong Jiang, Director of the Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.